Hello, this is Dmitry Grozobinski. The episode you're about to listen to was recorded on the 12th of April, when intelligence services were warning of a likely Iranian attack on Israel in retaliation for the bombing of Iran's consulate in Damascus. The episode therefore contains our speculation and analysis, which has of course been significantly overtaken by events. We're uploading the episode anyway in the hopes that you find our discussion about the implications and the thinkings of the actors here of interest. Though, of course, events have made some of the speculation in this episode redundant in hindsight. John, Helen, and the whole team at International Intrigue will have thoughtful, considered, and accessible analysis in your inbox soon, if it's not there already by the time you hear this. For now, however, welcome to Intrigue Explained.
I'm John Fowler, the co-founder of International Intrigue, the only daily newsletter briefing written by former diplomats. And with me, as last week and as always, we've got Dmitry Grozobinski, the founder and director of Explained Trade, a trade consultancy based in Geneva. Dmitry, how are we doing?
I'm doing well. You know, every time you describe your newsletter that way, which, by the way, is hugely underselling it, because diplomats are just chancers and you guys do a phenomenal amount of research work. All I can picture is you traveling around the world just slapping Substacks out of diplomats' hands. Like, no.
Not written by a former diplomat, because you're a current diplomat.
Exactly.
Exactly. Well, I better introduce the other half of Intrigue. That's Helen Zhang, my co-founder, everyone knows. Famous world traveler, still in Australia, still in Perth. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. This is the longest I've stayed put for a long time, John. So yeah, feeling good.
It is.
Feeling itchy.
Let's lift the lid on the back room of this podcast a little bit. How long precisely did it take to upload your video and audio last week with Australian internet?
Quite literally 7 hours. No exaggeration for folks playing at home.
This is not funny. No, it's not funny. It's a clarion call to Australian infrastructure providers to sort out the internet down there.
That's right. I'll just be joining by a carrier pigeon next time.
If you wouldn't mind just writing in your responses, that would be great.
You can do dramatic readings of Helen.
This week, we're going to talk about two things, but the main one is, and I think everyone is asking the same question, at least in the geopolitical circles, is what the hell is going on with this Iranian threat, these Iranian rumors of a strike on Israel? For a couple of days now, there's been rampant rumors in the US kind of geopolitical circles, in the UK, obviously in Israel, that an Iranian strike on Israel is imminent. Nothing yet. So we're going to have a conversation about what's going on. Is this real? If it is real, why is it so publicly known? We're going to dive into all of that. But before we do, I think we just wanted to mention and have a very quick discussion about the Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida's visit to Washington, D.C. this week. So for background for folks, he's been in D.C. on a state visit. He had one of those wonderful pomp and circumstance state dinners on Wednesday night with Jeff Bezos and the Clintons and all the other folks that they roll out when they want to impress people or, you know, at least intimidate them. And he's in America for a couple more days, along with the Philippines president, Ferdinand Marcos, or Bongbong to his friends and to everybody. So we're just going to quickly dive into what is going on. Helen, do you have any thoughts off the top of the kind of news about why Kishida's in town, what he's trying to achieve?
John, he's there for the trees. It's tree diplomacy, right? I mean, he's given about 250 cherry trees, which are famously lining DC's basin, right? So around the sort of
cherry blossom
man-made
season.
Lake sort of thing that they've got going.
Tidal basin,
that's it. They've had to kind
you
of
live
like,
there. You should know this stuff.
Shh, come on, John. They've had to, you know, try and refurbish the tidal basin. So a lot of the trees, including a really infamous one called Stumpy, has seen better days. So I think it's been very good tree diplomacy by Kishida to get in there and replenish the stock. But look, more seriously, of course, they're there to talk about the defense cooperation, because of course, Japan is famously a very strong ally of the US, and talking about JAUKUS. Now, would someone else like to explain to us what JAUKUS is? Not just a random acronym.
Is it jaundice, but you mispronounced it?
Correct. Yes. Yeah. 10 points to John.
I think this is the idea that Japan's going to join the AUKUS security pact, right? I'm skeptical of that just because I think there's a lot of kind of process and infrastructure things that would need to happen. But I will note that I believe that they announced, or at least it's been announced recently, that Japan is kind of joining a joint command with the US, which is that first step in integrating the two militaries, or not integrating, but making them into more interoperable, as it were. I'm no military expert, but one of the key kind of takeaways for me about AUKUS, which is the Australian, UK, US defense, I'm not going to call it a defense pact, a security agreement, kind of whatever it is. One of the key takeaways of that for me is just that it makes the three militaries really good at talking to each other and operating together, because it's really difficult to do, to have foreign militaries kind of just join your military and act in a way that a military is effective. And that's the whole point of joint exercises and all that kind of stuff. But this is like much deeper, right? This is like from procurement through strategy, through everything. But Dimitri, give us your thoughts.
No, I think that's two really important points that people, I think, should understand. The first one, the history of the Australia-UK-US pact, which when it was first announced, I think was greeted by a lot of people as, is this just a really complicated way to get out of a French submarine contract and buy sort of UK-US submarines instead? But is, as John says, a bit more than that, in the sense that alliances have a political component and, as John was saying there, a practical integration component. There is what you agree to do politically in the event that one of you gets in trouble with another country. But in practice, having militaries fit together, having your intelligence services be talking to each other, doing procurement jointly, all these kind of things, they don't just happen. And militaries are by definition fairly sort of insular creatures that don't do things in collaboration with others. So something like an AUKUS or a JAUKUS, if Japan were to join, would be an attempt to sort of increase that integration and cooperation. As John also said there, it's a little bit more difficult to imagine Japan joining because Australia, the UK, and the US are all part of Five Eyes, the intelligence sharing alliance of the sort of, I'd say, Anglophone Western world, which means that they already have a lot of shared security protocols, whereas the Japanese, for example, handle security completely differently in terms of their intelligence security.
Well, I think that's really, it's an interesting point too, because we're not, you know, and I guess this could go either way, but Japan up until very recently was famously not particularly, it had a self-defense force. The idea was it was investing in things that only allowed it to protect itself from attacks rather than the ability to project power, which is what we're talking about here. I mean, that changed kind of under Shinzo Abe, maybe a decade ago. Again, I'm not an absolute expert on this stuff, but so maybe that makes the Japanese military and the Japanese military posture more easy to integrate into a foreign kind of security agreement, because they don't have decades and decades and decades of processes and policies around what it looks like to project their power off their coast. Or maybe it makes it much harder because they don't have any experience and they don't know what they're doing, and like they're inexperienced in this. So I don't know what the answer to that is, but I think what we're going to end up with if this goes ahead, and I think it will, because Japan has done a lot of work on the kind of military side to make sure it can join in this alliance or security agreement or whatever we're going to kind of frame it as. They've done a lot of work internally to make sure they can join it, because I think they're really worried about China. But I think it's probably going to look more like a AUKUS core with Japan kind of closely collaborating where it can and where it sees interest. But Helen, I don't know if you see it differently.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I think that they're going to also try and tap into this Philippines component as well, right? Of like starting this global infrastructure fund of kind of getting in ports and getting in sort of agriculture, clean energy, all of that stuff that I think the US is trying to kind of increase links with those countries on as well. So of course, Japan stands to benefit there. The only other thing I wanted to add about Kishida's visit is that he made some very interesting remarks, sort of like a rallying cry to Americans to not forget where America stands and what they stand for in the world. I know I see you nodding there, John, but I mean, it was quite incredible because I think Japanese kind of overtures like this are quite rare. And certainly sort of by PM Kishida, who doesn't have as high a profile as Seishin Zawabe in the past in terms of their very, what's that word, like sort of forward-leaning foreign policy positions, right? So we're sort of reminding America it was still critical to the role of like ensuring democracy thrives, especially in the world that we live in today. So I thought that was quite an interesting one to watch. As well as, of course, as you mentioned, Jeff Bezos sort of, you know, strutting down the White House with his new wife and all the other glitterati of the political class.
Can I just second that speech that he gave to Congress, which was, I think the way it was billed is attacking American self-doubt. He sort of said that it feels to the rest of us like you guys are having a crisis of confidence, like you're reevaluating what is your place in the world. And here is Japan, which, you know, world's third largest economy, I think, depending on how you count the European Union, a really important regional player and quite a sort of formidable country in its own right, coming to Congress and basically going, no, guys, you're exactly who you thought you were. Like, this is how we look at you, and you need to get up off the mat and stop navel gazing, because the international order is at least in part based on a confident US and not one that is looking exclusively inward or trying to retreat from the world. And I thought that was sort of an interesting thing to do in Congress, where I think a good number of people do not necessarily feel that way.
Yeah, I mean, you know, both of you know that I bang on about this all the time, that America's role in the world is super important, that they should be in those places, but that they need their partners to meet them halfway. Because what almost the most important question for the next, let's say, short to medium term of global geopolitics on very, very grand kind of level is how America perceives its role abroad. Like that to me is the defining question that sort of touches on all the other points. Will they make mistakes? Will they stuff up? Of course they will, but it's more about how they perceive themselves. So in a European conflict, what do they perceive their own role? What's their role in Asia? How do they view themselves? And unfortunately, that is a question that is dominated right now by, I'm not going to say which side of politics, because I think it's truly on both sides of American politics, but absolute, to use your word, chances. Like people who are looking for every single opportunity. They are looking at it agnostically from what's good for the world, what's good for America, and they are looking at it purely politically about, can I wedge my opponent so that I can get elected? Can I wedge my opponent so I can raise more money from someone? Is there someone who's rich who can give me money, who has a vested interest? I will adopt their view. And it's a real problem because it affects more than, you know, the 4th district in Wyoming or the 12th district in Minnesota. It affects the whole world. And I think what Kishida did quite effectively last night, DC time, what European leaders have done to varying levels of effectiveness. And I think what Australia does, knowing, like I know this, what we try to do much more behind the scenes through our embassy and through our, you know, very deep integration into the American political system, is we try to say this stuff behind closed doors, but it is, you guys can't you have to figure this out. You have to figure out what you view yourself in the abroad, what your role is in the world. Now, if it's less than it used to be, that's not ideal, but okay, stick to it. Tell us and stick to it. If Europe has to stand on its own 2 feet a little bit more and we have to up our spending in NATO, we can do that, but tell us and stick to it. If you aren't going to be coming to the defense of Taiwan, or if you're not committed to the Asia Pacific, like you've said you have been for the last 15 years, that's not ideal, but tell us and we'll adapt. What you can't keep doing, and I think this is Kishida's message, what you can't keep doing is just this will they, won't they political infighting in Congress when you don't know if we're going to support Ukraine. We don't know if we're, you know, all of that kind of, I mean, you know this point. We've made it on this podcast a ton of times before, but it's clear that the world is just saying, please don't retreat. But if you do, tell us
just
and be
clear.
Just
give us a heads up. Yeah, and right. It's also about like America's own perception of what they're capable of as well, right? I think that sort of stems, I think they're probably like a chicken egg situation, particularly as we're seeing in Ukraine, of saying, okay, we are capable of producing X amount of ammunition that we can give to Ukraine, but can we really do it? You know, are we able to do it within the time frame which Ukraine needs to win? And sorry, I'm going off track talking about Ukraine there, but there's a lot of that self-navel gazing and their sort of like forecasting based on what they believe in themselves.
Yeah, and the cynical position here would be to say, fine, but we've talked about this before in the podcast too, is like, why should America be in those places? And I don't think that other countries have necessarily helped themselves, because they, a cynic, and I'm sure this will be going around Republican strategist talking point ideas today, is Japan just trying to take advantage of America's spending power? Like, they don't have a strong economy. They're the ones on the front line of China. Is Kishida just trying to be like, oh, we need America because then we don't have to pay for our own defense? I don't think that's true, but like, that will be a way to spin another ally saying, hey, America, come spend your money here because we need it. Like that, and that's how they spun the Ukraine stuff, right? Yeah. Like, oh, Europe doesn't want to spend its own money to defend itself. Why should we?
Yeah, exactly. Well, it's a pretty cheap deal for Kishida, all those trees and just, you know, an American security deal. So good for
and
him.
And it comes back to a point, and I'm ranting a bit, so I'll stop, I promise, but it comes back to a point that I think I ended a podcast on maybe 2 months ago, which I still haven't heard a political person in the US make a short MAGA-type slogan arguing for America's place in the world. Mm. We have clearly, I mean, they're not true and they are deceptive, but we have heard the other side. We have heard the America first, withdraw from the world, put up the borders, all that kind of, build the wall. We've heard those slogans advocating for the other side of this kind of political divide, I guess, but no one has come out and compellingly turned what we talk about all the time into a politically resonant, easily digestible message. And I still haven't heard that.
You probably won't before November, to be honest.
I'm not sure you will after November, because I don't think it's that easily sloganizable, especially because it's not as if there is a world, you know, there were slogans, for example, in World War II. When the US was pushing itself to enter World War II, there were slogans. But in that case, it was an acute kind of conflict crisis where you could determine an endpoint. What we are talking about here is much more of a kind of endless series of US actions attempting to maintain a stable, in places democratic, vaguely predictable, sort of occasionally just international order, and pushing back on the more egregious kind of bullies and expansionists and international chauvinists out there in the world. That is hard to condense into a slogan because it has no endpoint and it has no individual goal. It is just an endless series of, unfortunately, kind of alliance building, firefighting, and patching that the US ends up having to do because they're the only ones who can. And so I have some sympathy for the people that you're asking for a slogan from. I can see why it's so hard to summarize.
So I completely agree with you, but I think you are suffering, and it is to your infinite credit that you're suffering from this. You are suffering from the expert's problem of knowing what you're talking about and realizing how complex it is, and then being like, well, you can't in good faith accurately boil this down to a sentence, but the nature of modern politics is that you have to. And, you know, immigration policy is one of the most complex things on the planet. We know that in Australia. We know that just generally. It becomes build the wall. Trade policy, Dimitri, something close to your heart, the idea of supply chains becomes make America great again or America first. And that encompasses everything to do with the WTO, everything to do with global supply chain resilience, nearshoring, all like everything boils down to four words. Is it accurate? Is it realistic? Is it true? Is it nuanced? Of course it's not. Is it a lie? Arguably. But my point here is I think experts like you who know how difficult this is don't know how to communicate politically because it's not your job. And politicians who do know how to communicate like that don't understand the nuance. But the other side of politics, and I want to be very clear, this isn't a left-right Democrat-Republican thing. This is more like a populist cynic versus, view of the world, kind of world order divide rather than kind of left or right or anything like that. But the one side of that divide is having its lunch absolutely eaten by the other side because it clings to what you've just said, which is it's too difficult to boil down into it. We need to make complex arguments. We need to educate the public. I truly think if that happens, we are going to lose the people who believe in what you just said, Dimitri, are going to lose this argument because we're not willing to say, I don't know what the argument is, because I'm not good at it either.
But. Well, I'm going to put you on the spot here. You've got the rest of the podcast to come up with a sort of like one-liner slogan, okay? So we can move on to
something else. Do what John says. How about that?
Okay. All right. We'll go with that. But if you have, I mean, if you have time, think about the tidbits at the end. I'd love to hear what your thoughts
are. I want to give Dimitri the last word before we jump onto Iran, because he was, as I was making that argument, he was using his face to convey his displeasure with my points.
Well, first of all, how dare you? Secondly,
twas ever thus.
I guess I would push back on it a little bit, which is to say that, look, demagoguery isn't new, and we've been experiencing this demagoguery for a while. But at the same time, you know, Donald Trump, for all of his demagoguery, has never won the popular vote in the US. Aid to Ukraine is still polling really well. Actually, immigration polls in the US, for example, polls really well. There are people who say, you know, we need to get control of the border, which makes things more complicated. But I don't think it is necessarily fair to say that as much as team complexity is getting its butt kicked in the headlines, I also think, as you often remind me, we do need to give the general public some credit here, which is to say that outside of really loud people on Twitter, most of the general public has actually been far more capable of going, that sounds a bit too good to be true, or that sounds a bit simplistic, or just intuitively, actually, no, I think we should do something else, even in the face of relentless populism and demagoguery. So I do think, as you often tell me, we should give, I think, the public more credit for political centrality, nuance, than what you've just said implies. Not to suggest that that's what you think, but you know. I just wanted to add that point.
No, I think it's a great point. And with that, let's move on to our main topic of today, which is what the hell is going on with Iran. So let me just quickly set this up for folks who may not be, you know, as deep on X or Twitter or whatever you want to call it as we unfortunately are. So let's start with last Monday or Tuesday, depending on what time zone you're in. I think it was the 2nd of April. Israel fighter jets shot a ton of missiles at the Iranian consulate in Damascus in Syria. It seems like a bunch of Syrian anti-air defense missiles, or, you know, their system of shooting missiles out of the sky, shot down a bunch of Israeli missiles, but a couple got through and essentially leveled the Iranian consulate in Damascus, which we can get onto this, and I'm sure we will, is, you know, a pretty crazy thing in international relations to militarily target a consulate or an embassy of a foreign country. The photos of it, I would commend our listeners to go and have a look at what it did, because it really did raise the building to the ground. And in that building, which is why Israel struck it, were a bunch of Iranian Revolutionary Guard commanders, general level commanders. And the Iranian Revolutionary Guard is kind of Iran's crack force of foreign military intelligence, kind of military wing, does a bunch of things, but mostly it's the kind of elite foreign part of the Iranian government that is the military part of it. So anyway, long story short, people have been expecting an Iranian response, as you might expect. Israel attacking an Iranian consulate, what's Iran going to do in response? This week, I want to say Wednesday, maybe Tuesday, we started to hear a couple of rumors about an imminent Iranian strike on Israel. And then on Wednesday, and I'm pretty sure it was Wednesday, Biden addressed this. The US made official statements that we have heard intelligence chatter, we have heard rumors, sources are telling us that Iran is going to strike Israel imminently and we need to be aware. Lufthansa, I think, allegedly diverted flights around Iranian airspace. A ton of European countries have warned their citizens not to go there. I think now America has done that as well. Israel has publicly briefed that they are expecting a retaliatory attack, but we have had no attack and Iran has kind of mostly denied that they are going to attack Israel. So long-winded setup, but I think it's important to have that context. Dimitri, I'm going to throw to you first because Helen is the expert here. So I'm going to let you, you know, hoist yourself by your own petard before she comes in and corrects you. What's your reaction to this? I mean, this whole podcast is going to be speculation and us giving our gut vibes, but go ahead.
Helen's just waiting to correct me when I incorrectly place Iran somewhere in Central America. So my first reaction upon saying it is I think this attack on the consulate, setting the sort of morality and international legality of it aside and speaking about it in purely kind of strategic terms, puts Iran in an uncomfortable position for a number of reasons. First, there's a sense that they do have to respond somehow. It's such a nakedly and unequivocally provocative act to take out a consulate of Iran, deliberately to take out an Iranian Republican Guard leader. It's sort of very much in your face. At the same time, if I were Iran right now, I would be remembering the adage, don't interrupt your enemy when he's making a mistake. Because if you sort of look at how the war in Gaza is playing out from Iran's perspective, I think they would say, like, the best thing they could do at the moment is keep their heads down and
it's
allow.
Gone absolutely perfectly for them.
Yeah. They couldn't have scripted it better. Israel is losing a lot of its support. It's mired in an attempt to militarily dismantle a terrorist organization that's embedded in the populace, which, as we know, is sort of a fundamentally hopeless task.
An ideology.
It's dragging on. There's political strife at home. They've got strife with their allies. There's allies talking about cutting off. Like, from their perspective, the last thing Iran wants to do right now is fundamentally change the narrative and introduce an external threat to Israeli security that can sort of pivot the US conversation back to defending Israel as an ally from external threats.
Let's put a pin in that thought, because I think that is a super interesting point. I want to, Helen, I want you to just jump in, like, basically on the big picture. What do you, like, what do you think is going on? And then I want to, like, that last point of Dmitry is the one we want to pull that thread a bit. But, like, more generally, do you think, is there something here, I guess, is what I'm asking. Is this legit, or is this, like, Twitter rumors and
yeah, is there a there, as, like, the Americans, exactly, the consultants say? Yeah. Look, I think this is a real thing, right? If you remove the Israel-Gaza war aside, if you look at just the Israel-Iran sort of shadow war, proxy war, whatever you want to call it, that's been going on for, like, decades, right? This has been a tit-for-tat. There's always a very sort of relatively proportionate kind of act for every sort of breach by either side, either through the proxies or Iranian proxies like Hezbollah, or sort of through the Houthis in Yemen, or through sort of the Iraqi Shiite forces, right? And of course, some say Hamas in Gaza. So that's always been like a thing, right? If we're going to look at it that way. And this is the thing that distinguishes this particular attack is the fact that this is directly targeting Iran. So this is one of the first times that Israel has directly hit an Iranian target that is not sort of through a proxy. So I think that regardless of what kind of, you know, the Iranians think or should be doing in terms of what makes sense, they are not going to do that because they have a domestic audience, which the Ayatollah and others will need to appease, and they will need to be seen to be responding to it publicly.
And not through their proxies, right? Like a normal response here would be, okay, get Hezbollah to fire a bunch of rockets.
Correct.
Or get Hamas
yeah.
to do something.
Yeah.
But they can't, because they want that plausible deniability such that
exactly.
it goes both ways. Like, oh, we don't control Hezbollah. Well, then it also doesn't work when we want you to respond if Hezbollah responds, because you tell
absolutely.
Us you don't control
yeah.
them.
Yeah.
Right.
And look, zooming back out into sort of this, the Israeli pictures, right? So I think Netanyahu has always been very successful at sort of galvanizing Israeli support behind him when he sort of pits Israel against the world. His sort of whole thing is like, we are up against the world because there is a big external threat that is an existential threat to Israel. He's always kind of run on that line. And often that existential threat has been Iran. And so this guy actually kind of works for him domestically to say, hey, look, now there's a really big threat. I'm, again, the sort of like captain at the helm. I'm going to steer you through this crisis. So beyond the sort of tit for tat and beyond the sort of Israel-Gaza stuff, I think that there's very probable likelihood that this will escalate into something. I just don't know whether it's going to be now or whether it's going to be a few weeks down the track or another sort of Friday, Saturday, you know, which is the Shabbat, sort of the Sabbath days for Israel, when there's like not a lot of clouds in the sky, right? This tactical stuff, I think, will come in later on. But, you know, you've got to remember that Israel is also distracted on the southern front. And this is something that Iran has, like, in terms of strategizing and wargaming, this is exactly the sort of situation which Iran's generals have been kind of hoping for.
Okay, so I'm gonna try and, as we go along, kind of sum up a bunch of this stuff just for my own clarity. So we're saying, one, this strike on the consulate is, you know, I mean, it's kind of outrageous. What, no matter what side you're on, just as a kind of naked apolitical kind of international event, it's a kind of big deal, right? So we think that Iran kind of has to be seen, at least internally, for its own political standing and probably for its general power projection outside. It has to be seen to be doing something in response, hopefully right. proportional, but it has to be seen to be doing something. Now, I want to pull on the thread that Dimitri raised and that you kind of alluded to there with Netanyahu, is that this kind of benefits, the speculation, not the attack, but the speculation kind of benefits Israel, because we've talked about in the newsletter, we've talked about here, it has 100% or 99.5% lost the global narrative battle. If you were in support of Israel's response to wiping out Hamas in the hours, days, weeks, even months after the horrific terrorist attack, there's a pretty good chance you've softened your view because of the way Israel has, I would say, my words, overreacted and been pretty brutal in its response. But the idea of an Iranian attack on Israeli sources, people in the country, that helps targets, Israel. Yeah. So, mm-hmm. So here's my provocative question to Dimitri. Is there a chance that this is an Israeli psyop slash narrative plant to suggest, hey, remember, we are in a region where everyone wants to kill us? Is it a narrative play, or is there something legit here?
So I think if what you're asking is, was the decision to hit that consulate a deliberate attempt to bring Iran more out into the open in terms of its conflict? No, you're asking, are they planting the rumors of an Iranian attack, basically?
Well, not planting the rumors. I think that let's separate the attack, because I think that's probably a question that we won't ever know the answer to, but they've probably summed up the idea of, okay, we can take out a bunch of pretty senior generals and really damage their ability to operate. And yes, it's probably worth the cost and the blowback that we're going to get. My question here is more, and I'm not saying they're making it up, but the decision to release intelligence or to hint at it, to plant a couple of ideas in sources' heads about the possibility of an Iranian response, which if we, again, take at its naked kind of base level, it was like pretty predictable. Like, you hit an Iranian consulate, it doesn't take a genius to be like, oh, Iran will probably have to respond to this. So in one way, they're not saying anything that we don't know. They're just saying it's imminent, which 10 days after the attack, I could tell you as well. So my question more is, are they kind of bigging this story up in the media to kind of get the narrative flowing back in their favor?
It's hard to assign motive, but let me maybe take a quarter of a step back and take the coward's way out and say that that kind of narrative certainly serves them. Israel's support, especially from the US, is largely, and I've said this before on this podcast, is about the potentially existential threat to the country, right? This idea that Israel is surrounded by nation states with the, at least the theoretical capability of erasing its sovereignty and occupying its territory. At the same time, Israel has had a long-running sort of internal, incredibly messy, I don't even want to call it a conflict, an occupation with its Palestinian citizens is the wrong word because it won't give them citizenship, but with the Palestinians in Gaza and the West Bank. The U.S. policy, the U.S. response to even October 7th was first and foremost an attempt to prevent an escalation in the region, to prevent some of those other regional actors from seizing on the moment and doing something kinetic, whether it's sort of Hezbollah or others. At the moment, when the news is dominated by the Israeli domestic conflict, which even if you are 1,000% a supporter of Israel and believe that everything, that there is no other way that Israel could possibly have achieved its objectives and responded to October 7th and doing exactly what it's doing now, even if you kind of posit all of that, it still looks horrible. Externally, it looks horrible. I think the biggest supporter of Israel would admit that the optics are bad. In that circumstance, changing the conversation to, hey guys, remember our conflict. Yes, we have this sort of conflict with Hamas and Gaza and the Palestinian people, and that's ugly. But also, the reason you've been sending us weapons all this time, the reason you've been supporting us, is there's Iran, a global belligerent, that wants to destroy us. I think that that story does Israel no harm at all in Senate offices all over DC.
Mm-hmm. Helen, do you agree with that?
Unsurprisingly, I do agree with that. I mean, I think that this is, this kind of is like a pattern in sort of the Israeli Arab, broader Israeli Arab conflict, right? Dating all the way back from to the 1900s. I'm not going to take you through all the history there, but I think in particularly in recent years, there's been an effort, whether it's through PSYOPs or whether it's through sort of actual, you know, I think overt kind of support for military activities in like Syria, for example, there's always been some kind of manipulation or influence of the media to kind of cover Israel with a narrative of like, we are in this really dangerous zone where everybody is trying to take us out and we need to do something about it and we need your support. And hey, don't forget that. Mm. And this happens again and again and again. So yeah, I agree with Dim. I think that this is, again, plays exactly to Netanyahu's hands because it sort of feels like this is his trump card, right? He uses this every time. He famously has done this with the Iran nuclear deal, like to scuttle that, the initial, or try to scuttle the initial JCPOA, the Iran nuclear deal. And he always pulls out the Iran card every time things get dicey. So look, not to say that he sort of deliberately did
I don't think any of us are saying that it's not real, but it's just that, As we said, like the releasing of the, they've clearly seeded the idea with journalists because I think Reuters is getting exclusives. I think Washington Post had an exclusive. So they've seeded the idea with journalists. And we think maybe that the decision to do that is because of political benefit. But I want to potentially, obviously we don't know. Dimitri?
I think one of the things that's sort of playing into all this is that the way I would characterize Iran, and this is from a position of profound ignorance, is when it comes to Israel, they do not want to fight Israel directly, at least not at the moment. But at the same time, they very much want to project internally and regionally and even globally that they are the kind of country that wants to fight Israel, if that makes sense. So there's this sort of hold me back, bro, element to all of this. Where, I mean, the Iranian military isn't, I don't want to dismiss the Iranian military, but any scenario where open conflict breaks out with Israel almost certainly draws in the US and would probably end very, very badly for Tehran. I'm not talking about an invasion, but if we're sort of, if we're exchanging air force strikes on one another, I think Iran comes out of that looking a lot worse than Israel does for a whole bunch of reasons. I don't think they want that conflict, but at the same time, so much of their credibility at home and in the parts of the Arab world that don't hate them, which, you know, is small subsection, but is built on wanting that fight.
And I would also just say that, I mean, 40 years since the Islamic Revolution of, was it 40 years? Yeah, it's almost, you know, more than 40 years of the Islamic Revolution, is that their strategy has always been sort of cannily snip at the edges of Israel through proxies. And just as like a human organization kind of boring question, it's like you can't really change the DNA of all of the leaders who have come up through that system with that overarching strategy. They don't just suddenly become a group of people who think it's a good idea to kind of confront Israel straight on. Like that, in their bones, they are part of this strategy that I think arguably has worked pretty well for Iran of fighting Israel through proxies. So it's not plausible to me that they are looking to change that now. And particularly, as you said, like the attacks on October 7 have done exactly what I imagine they drew up in the boardroom of the Ayatollah's, you know, war room when they kind of at least sanctioned or gave Hamas the sort of flexibility to do that. I want to pivot this conversation a little bit because, so I think we think that Iran doesn't benefit from a direct conflict. So it's unlikely that that's what they're going to try and do, but they need to respond in some way. This probably benefits Israel at least until the attack happens or if it happens. But the key here is that the US has joined or is kind of the driver of bringing this to the global kind of rumor mill attention. I want to talk a bit about William Burns, the director of the CIA, who has since he took over in what, I think end of 2021, start of 2022, around that time. I can't quite recall when he was put in charge. He's a career diplomat, which I think is really important to know about him because he does, I mean, he's obviously worked in and out of various national security agencies, but his training is as a diplomat, not a spy. He has pushed America towards this policy of intelligence that is kind of what we've termed pre-bunking, the idea that before Russia invaded Ukraine, he declassified a ton of information about Russian troop buildups on the border. He tried to discredit Russian misinformation and disinformation before they even said it, which is a really interesting way of fighting this existential question in 2024, 2023, 2024, and going forward of how do you combat misinformation? And so far, his response has been, okay, make public what we know before we know what's going to happen, because it builds our credibility and decreases the other side's credibility. And I want to ask you both, if that's what's happening now, is the Wednesday announcement or whenever it was of Biden saying we'll stand with Israel if Iran is trying to destabilize Israel, that's not going to happen. We've got intelligence that an attack is going to happen. Are they trying to say, hey, when this attack happens, we warned you, and any Iranian kind of obfuscation, misinformation is nonsense because we've got the credibility and the runs on the board. Is that what's happening again?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they are just holding Iran on notice, right? This is sort of saying, hey, guys, we know this is about to happen. We have back-channeled this. Like, another thing to keep in mind is that the US, in addition to kind of pre-bunking, quote unquote, with very, very on vogue this term at the moment, but I really love it because I think it's a very accurate way of saying, you know,
I'm claiming that we came up with it. I've been saying it for 18 months.
Oh, absolutely. John Fowler. Yeah, I peed. But look, I think it's... they've, in addition to sort of speaking to the sort of Western allies, they've also been speaking to the Chinese, to like Wang Yi, right? The foreign minister behind the scenes is saying, hey, yep, guys, this is for real. You need to listen to us because we don't want this to happen. This is not in anyone's interest. So I think that it's really effective because not only are you doing the back channeling, which I think is a very diplomatic, traditional sort of tradecraft of diplomats, the sort of pre-bunking is kind of like diplomacy in the digital era, if you will, right? I think that's been a really interesting way of kind of looking at this, and lots of different cases that this has happened in the last few years, because we're dealing with a very different way that information is spread. And so you kind of have to like reinvent the tradecraft of diplomacy in this sense.
I think Helen's hit the nail on the head there. I think the difference with the pre-bunking, say in the Russia case, is that in the Russia case, the concern was Russia would do something while claiming it's not doing it, while pretending it's something else, while inventing a false flag. So the primary concern was, how do we make sure that Russia isn't able to muddy the waters? I think in this case, as Helen was saying, instead, this is much more about, you know, if Iran does something, especially Iran itself, rather than by its proxies, it'll probably proudly claim it. I think it's much more about starting a conversation with China and other players to basically say, hey, this isn't us just sort of chicken littling. We think this has gotten to such a stage where we're prepared to say publicly that it's imminent. We can't be the only ones trying to prevent this because we don't necessarily have that leverage with Iran. You need to send a signal to Iran that you won't have their backs.
Mm-hmm. The other interesting thing that kind of comes from the pre-bunking that, you know, happened certainly in the Russia case is that it puts other parties on notice. So it's not just kind of governments on notice, but it's private players, right? I think one of the first things that detected the Russian invasion was actually Google Maps, like seeing this like intense buildup of traffic across a border, right? And seeing sort of this traffic, like other satellite companies also tracking the activity there. So I think something like this and the maybe like civilian technologies that you see in the Middle East in future, perhaps, and certainly I think maybe in this case as well, in terms of the northern side of Israel and southern side, they'll have civilian technologies that are also put on notice to say, hey, this is real. Let's sort of see what we can find. I mean, that's a sort of like afterthought, less important than the China stuff you just made, Dim.
I actually think it's a really vital point because so much of what we get now, including intelligence agencies will admit this, intelligence agencies are getting stuff from OSINT, open source intelligent people. It is girls and guys on Discord servers trolling through satellite photos that they are buying from private companies, looking at the way that shadows fall on trees, identifying sort of missile launches from vans. And like one of the things that this does is it probably caused everybody from Bellingcat on down to start poring over maps and satellite images of Iran. And that feeds back into the intelligent thing as well. So I think that's a really, really smart point.
I agree. Let me play 4D chess for just a second, right? Okay, so all the thread that's running through all of this is that Western intelligence services, I think, in an era where disinformation, you can't stop it. Like, it's whack-a-mole, right? They've decided that the common way to fight it is credibility. You have to be credible. You have to have people believe what you say. You have lots of noise, lots of disinformation, but when a source, when a government source comes out and says something, the only way they can fight it is that source has to be believed, right? And the way you build credibility is just by kind of being a bit more transparent and right time and time and time again over a period of time. That's how, I mean, that's trust, right? You blow it up once, it's gone, but it takes a long time to rebuild. I think that's the strategy. So let me look, 4D chess here. US has nailed its colors to the mast a little bit. It's gone out and said, we're talking to China. If you're Iran or if you're China, or if you're an adversary of the US, you want to break down that credibility. So why would you just don't do anything now and just say, hey, look, it was nonsense. We tell you, they lie, and we didn't do anything. We didn't have plans to do anything. They even told China, and China, nothing happened, and China can come out and do the thing that they always do, which is like, America is only focused on its own interests. They come to us, they lie, we don't trust them, blah, 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 blah. And you start to chip away at that credibility. Is that, am I overthinking this? I mean, obviously Iran kind of has that political imperative that it has to do something, but
I think Iran should go one step further and just immediately declare a military alliance with Israel. Really make America look
disbanding
stupid.
Disbanding the Islamic Republic.
Checkmate, Biden.
Direct flights, Tel Aviv, Tehran. Yay.
I did say it was 4D chess.
Again, I think this is always the calculation with pre-bunking, because you are giving the other side the ability to embarrass you a little bit. But at the same time, if you think about foreign policy and intelligence as in large part about being able to shape the calculus and policy choices of other countries, it is hard to think of, if you are able just by sending some press releases, doing a press conference and having a chat with China, if you are able to make Iran one of your primary adversaries worldwide, reconsider military retaliation on your only ally in the region after their consulate gets blown up, if all it takes is you releasing, I think the National Security Council in the US would say that is a deal. We'll take that. We'll take looking a bit silly if it means we were able to prevent this from escalating. I reckon they'll take it.
Yeah, I think also the thing that can't be overstated here is that we are sitting here navel gazing and like doing all, you know, doing a whole what if the grand strategy. At the end of the day, like, it didn't take a genius to predict that Israel was going to massively overreact to the attacks on October 7, and we warned about it. I think in the newsletter, like a day or two afterwards, we were like, the hell does eradicating Hamas even look like? We know too much about how this stuff works now in the modern world that, like, it's impossible. What are they going to do? And yet they go and make that mistake, because at the end of the day, the people who are making these decisions have politely argued that they're not normal people. They don't consider these kinds of things. And they arguably, in Netanyahu's case, probably don't care that much about what we're talking about. They have political considerations and personal narcissistic considerations that almost always triumph. And in Iran, like, God knows, I'm not an expert, but like the amount of different things that influence the individual person's decision-making, who has the trigger or the not trigger or the target selection, you know, authority, we can sit here and be like, oh, it would be rational to do X, Y, and Z. But that's realistically, that's not how these decisions are often made, right?
No, exactly. And I think that, you know, if you look at sort of reports of or speculations about the actual targets that might be hit from medium range missiles from Tehran to somewhere in Israel, they're talking about things like the Dimona nuclear facility, you know, down south, or the Haifa airport, which is like one of the, I think, the biggest port for Israel on the Mediterranean. Like, that would also escalate into far more regional sort of strife than anything else that we've seen so far.
Perfect segue. Dimitri, is Iran going to attack Israel or an Israeli target in the next 72 hours? Say yes or no and don't be a coward. And say which target.
Say which target. Who do I think should start running?
I want the coordinates.
Jesus. I don't think they're going to do it. I think they are going to make a lot of threatening noises, but especially now that they not only do not have any element of surprise, but also now that sort of the US is this closely engaged, I think they're going to look at it and go, we've got a US aircraft carrier battle group parked off the coast and frankly an IDF air force that has really been itching to take out some Shahed drone factories and a few other choice targets. If I had to guess, and keep in mind, I got the Russia invasion of Ukraine wrong, so my radar is terrible.
It's a chance for you to redeem yourself, sir.
I was saying he's not going to do it because it's not going to work, and I was wrong, so I'm an idiot. But my sense is I ultimately don't think they do it, or they do it in such a limited way or with such a specific target that's nowhere near a nuclear power plant. Or
don't hedge. You've come out. You can't hedge. Helen, what's your take?
I think they're going to strike, and I think they're going to strike Israel's, offshore oil targets, because there are a lot of oil and gas fields that actually Israel has discovered in recent years and have started developing in the Eastern Mediterranean. And I think that could be a likely target. And or they're going to strike, but on Israeli targets in foreign sort of third locations, whether that's in Europe where they've got a lot of reach, or in elsewhere in the Gulf states, right? Perhaps that could be more easily done, or Turkey.
The desperate hedging I was doing that you cut me off was to get to sort of closer to Helen's position.
Sorry,
well, I'm still cutting you off. We're gonna edit out your hedging.
Damn it!
I also was wrong about Russia, Dmitry, and I think Iran will respond. So one of us is going to redeem ourselves, and one of us is going to be 0-2, and never be able to show their face again. But I agree with. I think the only logical thing is a proportional response. Shout out to my West Wing fans, because a proportional response is all there is. In the
what
words
is
of
the virtue of a proportional response?
It's what there is, as Leo says. And I think, for all the reasons we talked about, Iran doesn't want a direct conflict, but they probably politically have to be seen to be doing something. My caveat on it, to the extent I'm allowed one from Dmitry, is I don't see how they strike the Mediterranean oil fields, because they'd have to fire missiles over Israel, essentially. But I'm not a military expert, so perhaps there's a way for them to strike something over the top of Israel without kind of it being a real problem in terms of targeting and accidents and iron domes and all these kinds of things. But
the world's a circle. They'll just fly the other way, John.
Okay. There we go. And I truly don't know. I don't understand Iranian military capabilities. I don't understand how difficult that is. I just feel like a target there is more difficult than I think what you said, Helen, which is a target somewhere else. But I think a lot of that relies on what that target is. I don't know the region or Israel's foreign assets well enough to understand what a proportional target would be and whether there even exists one. Mm. But if Iran strikes, it will be that, I think. And I think they will, because they have to. So that's
got
my
that
that's
record.
My hot take.
Great.
Yep, you do. And I think it'll happen. I think it probably will happen pretty soon. So if not, then Dmitry wins. All right, let's leave it there. Before we send everyone off to their weekend or whenever they're listening to this, we always try to, give you a little bit of an insight into how poor party guests we are by telling you what we're going to be talking about this weekend at cocktail parties and general events. Helen, we're starting with you this week. What's on your mind? What are you going to be chattering about?
Once again, John, speak for yourself. I'm a delightful guest. I'm, as you know, I'm in Australia still, where I think, the top news here, the hard-hitting news here in Australia, of course, has been the reunification or the reunion is the right word, of this Insta-famous magpie called Molly, who had bonded with her adopted brother, sister, which is Peggy, a Staffy, a sort of Staffordshire Bull Terrier dog. So during COVID, the owners had rescued this magpie called Molly to kind of hang out with the family, and they have this really amazing bond and have built up this incredible following on Instagram. And then lo and behold, the Queensland authorities, John, looking at you here, came in and took the magpie away and separated it from its family because they said that they were not able to look after wildlife. And after many petitions, including I think Kelly Slater and other celebrities that weighed in, the Queensland Premier then intercepted and made sure that Molly was reunited with the family and her little sister Peggy the dog, so long as the family did not cash in on this, which is, I think, sort of a total bind, because obviously they've already cashed in on this and they've got book deals and stuff. But anyway, that is the top, hard-hitting news here in Australia, which I'm very
deeply unserious country in many ways, aren't we?
I mean, it's either that or the NRL, gosh, don't want to go into that. So
First we like threaten to kill Johnny Depp's dogs, then we save these ones. We have really inconsistent policies when it comes to pooches.
As a Queenslander, as you alluded to there, Helen, I have absolutely no sympathy for magpies. I was attacked repeatedly as a child by these damn birds.
Were you
birds.
The kid on and the scooter? That was you, that the famous reel.
I used to have to wear a hat with eyes in the back of it because they would stay. For folks who don't know, A, what a magpie is, it's a particular breed of vicious kind of bird in Australia that when it's nesting attacks anyone who walks nearby and tries to peck your eyes out, truly, just to add to the amount of
trauma
animals in Australia that are trying to kill you. But even as an adult in my late 20s, I remember walking home from my job and being attacked and cut by a magpie. So I
I remember, you know, that.
I'd fully support the absolute euthanasia of all those birds. But anyway,
oh, on that delightful note.
Yeah, exactly. I don't resile from it because I am not a coward. to change the topic, I'm going to be talking this weekend about two very quick things. One is, I don't know if folks have heard of this website called Atlas Obscura, but it's this, you know, this kind of travel website that sort of tries to unearth weird and wonderful things about the world and how you can travel to see them. And, you know, it's kind of ruins or whatever, you know, it's just cool stuff and it can be in your location too, stuff that you may never have thought about. But they also have this site called Gastro Obscura, which is kind of unearthing like weird or wonderful foods from around the world. And they have this article provocatively titled Why Jesus Never Ate a Banana. But the article basically is a really interesting kind of explanation of where all of the foods that might be in your diet actually come from natively. And this is something that I've always, since I lived in London and the quality of the produce in London is just appalling, I've been really interested in, because of course it's appalling. It's an island in the North Sea that is cold and windy and rainy for most of the year. It shouldn't have pineapples in the middle of winter. And it's not surprising that pineapples are bad quality in London. And I think this article does a really good job of showing you, I guess it's a massively impressive feat that we can get produce all around the world all times of years, but B, that we probably shouldn't be able to do that because climate change, supply chains, all that kind of stuff. But like bananas are from South Asia, for example.
There's nothing from Australia, John. I'm looking at the map here and it's a blank slate.
Well, nothing anybody eats, but like, you know, watermelon is actually from Southern Africa. So like, why are you able to get it in Montreal in January? These kinds of things are just interesting, I think. But it's also just interesting to know where actually stuff natively comes from. The tomato obviously coming from the Andes now being available everywhere. So I don't know, we'll put a link into it in the show notes. People can check it out.
What I'm getting here, John, is that you want to commit avian genocide and slap the fruit out of my hand.
Exactly. I'm trying to take us back to the glory days of circa kind of 1500s, I think.
God, you're really donning my mantle as the bum us all out.
The way podcast dynamics have to work, Dimitri, is one of us has to be so unlikable that the other two become likable just in reference to how unlikable I am. So you really should.
It's possible you're overcorrecting and have been for most of the run of this.
My personality generally is overcorrecting.
My cocktail party chatter will be, of course, about Donghua Jinlong Chemical. Have either of you heard of this?
It is
a good pronunciation.
Wholesome thing that has happened. So there is a company in China called Donghua Jinlong Chemical that produces food grade glycine. As part of their marketing, at some point, they made a YouTube video, apparently just for the SEO algorithm, where they sort of very earnestly talk about the benefits of Donghua Jinlong's food grade glycine and why their giant corporate customers may want to consider sourcing thousands of tons of Donghua Jinlong's chemicals, food grade glycine, from Donghua Jinlong.
What's glycine? Can you just
glycine? So it's a chemical compound,
like sugar or something,
sweetening and the stuff.
Okay,
it's just like, you know, one of those things on the ingredient list of a product that's just like got a number next to it. That's the
as a Diet Coke drinker. Yes, I do.
Yeah, they put this thing on TikTok, and TikTok started serving it into the algorithms of people, and now there is a global meme of people unironically building an entire meme ecosystem around Donghua Xinlong. They are having feuds with other Chinese companies about their inferior food grade glycine. They are doing like bits of it. They are inventing commercials. And it is all this one poor giant Chinese conglomerate, one product that the internet has just fallen in love with. And it is genuinely like, it's not mean, it's not toxic, no one's getting hurt. And it's just this shared monoculture moment in one corner of the internet that you can just have hours of fun with. Stand-up comedians are doing filming fake sets where they get heckled by competitors of Donghua Xinlong Chemical. It is genuinely like, go down the rabbit hole. You will not regret it. It is wonderful and uplifting. People are great.
So I shouldn't ruin it by saying it's probably, you know, the CEO of the company has probably paid someone in the Communist Party to tell the TikTok people to promote it and is going to get sentenced to death for corruption. I shouldn't say that.
I don't think the CCP is that creative. Like, honestly, God, this looks way too niche. And like, why would they choose that?
It's pretty funny.
I think this is real. I believe in Donghua Xinlong Chemical, and I will fight
to the death for their right to produce weird glycine industrial compounds.
Exactly.
Oh, that's
all right. Well, on that note, we will leave it there. As always, a real pleasure chatting to you. I think it's fascinating, and I'll be watching with interest with what happens, if only to see who's right about the Iranian strike. Dimitri, thank you very much. Have a great weekend.
Thank you so much. And of course, if I'm wrong, you will never hear from me again.
Helen, thanks so much. Safe journey back to the US, whenever that is.
Thank you, John. You will still hear from me, sadly, if I'm wrong.
All right, folks. Thanks. Until next week.
Dialogue editing, mixing, and mastering for this episode was done by Marissa Ewing of Hemlock Creek Productions.